I will resume with the Beresford special.
The poltergeist.
Beresford.
Buddha's submission to almost hell on his string, but I wanted to ask in a general sense whether, Mr. Bauer, you could see a way forward, given that the land is currently landlocked, that there are some real constraints imposed by district plan rules relating to the use of the land, and for historical reasons, even though it's used by the public, that it doesn't have public reserve status anymore. So, where do you think this is going to land, given the difficulties, in a general sense? I mean, what is open to us in terms of alternatives other than rejecting the submission, because we don't have the information that you suggest we should have? No, I mean, it's a very broad question, but I'm just trying to see beyond the current point in time and looking to the future as to how these matters might be resolved.
I normally wouldn't even contemplate a deferred zoning, but I accept that this case is sufficiently unique, so that with respect to the road access, and that's the principal reason for the Beresford submission requesting that the zoning is deferred until it's contingent on a road being supplied with the outline, the spatial layout plan. Especially in light of comments we've made about the merits of future urban subdivision outside the urban growth boundary, I can't say that they'd have that. You know, you could keep a zoned rural and try for a urban subdivision, because even with the complexities or the uniqueness around Section 8 of the Act and the issue with the road, I think they'd keep through that barrier through the urban development chapter. Putting aside the urban housing component of the subdivision, I think the site overall, zoned rural as a holding pattern, isn't necessarily that bad. The rural zone contemplates a wide range of activities, especially commercial ventures based on tourism, based on the rural land recreation resource. That's about as far as I can go, really, in suggesting a way forward. It's probably a better question to put to the applicant, but I, as I said in my evidence, I don't think that the rural zone is as bad as what it's made out to be in terms of not providing any future certainty for that landowner. Lots of people have undertaken ventures in the rural zone within the ONL and done okay in terms of obtaining resource consents. So that's something that shouldn't be discounted as well. So that's about all I can, about as far as I can go in terms of crystal ball gazing about what else you could do with that land.
I didn't want it suggesting that you could provide a solution on the types of activities, but more to do with the method of addressing a pretty unique problem. I think you've answered it in part.
is. The other half of my answer is probably sitting in my rebuttal, really. Yeah.
Thank you.
The thing that's troubling me, Beresford, Bath, is that we're running headlong towards Section 85 application. This land is incapable of reasonable use as a result of the zone provisions and or the provisions of the plan. Overlaid with the Treaty of Waitangi issues to add spice to the operation.
Is that a question or an assertion?
Quite possibly an assertion. And that, are you, in terms of the reasonable use that might be made of this land, is this commercial tourism or bust? Is that the only practical use we can point to?
It is constrained, I accept that much. But there is already a recreation resource established on the site.
I suppose the question might be, after decades, the public regarding it as free recreational use, is there any prospect that the mountain biking community will be prepared to pay for it?
Well, that's probably a question for a market economist.
Might ask Mr. Greenaway that.
That's right.
But if he says no, what's the council's planning response going to be on the basis that that will, in effect, snooker the only practicable use we can across this room that we've been able to identify?
Yes, that's a fair point.
And I have freely admit that I haven't figured out the answer to that one out myself. But I'm very much about where Commissioner Hudson is scratching my head. Now, in terms of the actual application of the RPs, you talked about these provisions recognising the role of Kaitahu. Are we dealing with Kaitahu? Given that this is for the purposes of the RPs, the operative RPs, clearly they're all, the beneficiary, the owners are all members of Kaitahu, or Naitahu, depending on your perspective. But as a planning provision, in terms of all the provisions of the RPA, the operative RPS, the proposed RPS, the PDP, are we dealing with Kaitahu? I'll ask Mr. Beresford that question, but what's the council's view?
Reason to think that we're not, while acknowledging that this is the outcome of a process of redress, but the beneficiaries are Kaitahu.
Just I seem to recall that the Kaitahu, as defined by the Treaty Settlement Act, is Trot. I'm not sure, I think it's Kaurunanga o Naitahu. And anyone authorised by Trot, and no one else. That might be a legal question, but view of the fact that we have to give effect to those provisions in the operative RPS, I think we need to know the answer. And so ask for the council's response, full response, with some legal analysis. And the other question is, everyone's talking, you and indeed Mr. Christoff, a frequent reference to the principles of the treaty. Which particular principle or principles are in issue here?
Redress. That the Crown should remedy past grievances where the Council, are part of this now because the Crown has allocated land to the beneficiaries and the Council are a part of this process now because the beneficiaries are wanting seek redress for environmental gains from that site.
In terms of your point referring to the operative RPS at 11.26 of your rebuttal, the obligation to give effect to the Ngāi Tahu Claim Settlement Act, is there anything specific in the Ngāi Tahu Claims Settlement Act specific to this land? What result does being required to give effect to the Act have in practice? What obligation does it impose as regards this land?
I reserve my answer on that and get back to you formally.
Certainly. Paragraph 1136, you qualify your analysis by referring to the possibility that there might be existing use rights as regards the forestry operation. To the extent there might be existing use rights, do you think they include this clearance of the forest? Has it ever been cleared before?
I don't think so. Would harvesting be the same nature and scale as intensity as the forestry activity as it intended to be when it was originally established?
Rhetorical question.
Sorry, yes, sir, yes it was.
What's your answer to your own question?
Well, I stand by my report, and that I think that concept needs to be further explored. I mean, it could be a drawing a long bow, but forestry's complicated in that. Well, it's not that complicated, but if there's the active forestry, then there's the active planting it, then it's maintaining it, and then at some point in time it gets harvested, and that's when things can get really messy and noisy. But if that's undertaken in the same area as what was originally planted, I wouldn't surprise to see someone making a case somewhere for that being the same nature and scale of what was originally intended when it was a committed activity.
I know just the woman who would do that. Not looking at the lady on your left. To ask you last about your propositions in 1178, that any proposed development, as you see, should include a structure plan that provides certainty of a minimum amount of trails to be retained, location of connections, and a commitment to the retention or rehabilitation of trails. And I wrote in large letters in my margin, why? Why should a private landowner provide for public use of their land?
I think there'd be an expectation on any person subdividing, even within the low-density residential zone, to provide connections throughout their neighbourhood, to the wider neighbourhood. And in this case, everybody seems to accept that they're quite thin on the ground in terms of development rights as a starting point. So, and given what's already there, I think that would be a good way to integrate any future urban environment with the existing track network.
Right, that's all I had. Any more on Beresford? Glenahasset Family Trust. Any questions on my right? It's a no. Another Blenner has it. This will be the family trust, I take it. Mr. McCassie, you don't. No on my left. No on my right. Hawthornden.
Mr. Barr, my understanding of where you've got to here is that you would support the rezoning of what's been identified as Area C, but on the basis that there's a corresponding upzoning of the adjacent properties, which in your report were identified, once I get through this, as the Stadholm Road Rural Lifestyle Zone submission. And so what I wanted to understand is that we could, in line with your recommendations, support the upzoning for the Stadholm Road Rural Lifestyle Zone landowners, but not support Area C for Hawthornden. But we could only support Area C for Hawthornden if we also supported the Stadholm Road Rural Lifestyle Zone submissions. Have I got that right? Or could we support Hawthornden but not support the Stadholm Road?
I think they can be addressed exclusive of each other. If I've written that somewhere, then I'd better have another look at that because there's a relationship between the two, of course, but in terms of there's an effect on accepting one zoning and it means that the other one is seen less favourably, I don't think that's the case. So I support both rezonings and they're exclusive of each other.
Because at 10.12 you see as part of your view for the Studholme Road group was, and I quote, on the basis of my recommendation to rezone Area C of Hawthornden. And so I think, to be fair, your report isn't written such that I think the reader would casually think the two are exclusive.
Mm.
But you're saying they are such that we wouldn't need to determine one before we could determine the other.
Yeah, I'll just read this. Yes, I haven't written that very well. I think what I was trying to say is that because there's two, there's going to be potentially two, a 35 hectare and a 56 hectare areas of rural lifestyle zone land, it is quite contiguous in terms of a lump of rural lifestyle on the district plan maps. I don't know why you couldn't figure that out from reading that. Sorry, that's not written very clearly. I think that's what I was trying to say.
But they're not contingent on each other.
No, they're not.
So in terms of back to Hawthornden site itself, could you just give me a clearer summary, because I couldn't quite get it from your evidence, why, what it is that C has that A and B don't have in terms of support for one and not the others, and putting aside the matter of the next door landowners, as we've just agreed to go to one side.
So Area A, as I think is too sensitive in terms of, even though it's a Section 7,
yeah,
landscape, I just maintain that it's too sensitive to be zoned to rural lifestyle. The landscape assessment that supports the Hawthornden submission hinges on qualifiers such as the accesses. Well, it's preferable that the accesses aren't on the northern part of the site. That takes an assumption that people are going to go down the most conservative path in terms of, or the most sympathetic path in terms of designing it. I accept that there are assessment matters in the subdivision chapter for the rural lifestyle zone that look at the location of building platforms, and the council's reply is that it has a restricted discretionary activity status. But a rural lifestyle zone subdivision would not expect to be supported by a landscape architect. There's no real onus to find the parts of the site that have the most capacity to absorb development, which is what the Section 7 landscape assessment matters ask you to do. So in my view, that's why I think that rural lifestyle zone isn't appropriate for Area A. For Area B, Area B effectively is reliant in many respects on Ms. Malsop's advice that she doesn't support it from a landscape perspective. If Ms. Malsop did support Area B from a landscape perspective, my recommendation would be to make it a large lot residential zone and extend the urban growth boundary. I've never written that though, because I didn't get that far in terms of her recommendations.
Okay, so from my site, from our site visit, my recollection of Area A was that it felt like it was more of a bank facing down into town. I can understand a lot of those landscape sensitivities, but from where we got to on Area B, it seemed to have a lot of the characteristics of Area C in terms of being flatter and being more out of view. And notwithstanding your comment about large lot residential there, I was actually going to go the other way and test you with what if it was a rural lifestyle.
Yes, I think I hinted that in my report, but they're not asking for that, and their evidence
Has been occurred in other submissions, there might be room for us to make a decision that is somewhere between the status quo and what's being sought.
I need to check what Ms. Malsop says, but
if you could do that, I'd prefer
that,
because I'd like us to make sure we have tested every option available to us.
Putting aside the landscape sensitivity component, I'm obviously a lot more, as you would have read, a lot more comfortable with rural lifestyle on the other side of the urban growth boundary.
Yeah, look, I understand that's got a policy consequence generally as well as specifically for the characteristics of the site. Look, I don't have any other questions there.
Thank you. Can I ask you to look at 9.6? You're referring to the objective of maintaining a clear distinction between urban and rural areas. I'm not sure if it's these abutters, but I know some of the planners seeking rural residential zones that have pointed to the provisions of Chapter 22 suggesting that that is the role of rural residential zones. That's point one for you to think about and say, well, in a planning sense, is it a function of this particular site that rural residential is not appropriate on this side, or is that a general issue about rural residential hard on the other side of the UGB?
So the latter, it's the general concern about the rural residential zone hard on the UGB, and it's the same with the Red Eye Riverbank Road submissions as well.
That may well be where I read the planning.
Chapter 22 does talk about rural living opportunities and sometimes around sensitive locations, but I think that is trumped by the strategic directions policy and the urban development chapter policy that talks about Wanaka maintaining distinction between urban and rural.
And I suppose that's going to be my second question. Where exactly does the plan talk about a clear distinction between urban and rural areas? Because I can seem to recall there's lots of mention of transitions.
Policy 4.2.8.1.
Say that again.
Policy 4.2.8.1.
That's the Wanaka-specific UGB provision, isn't it?
Yes. A distinction between urban and rural areas is maintained to protect the quality and character of the environment and visual amenity.
And as we've discussed, rural residential is not very rural. Again, talking about hazards, are you concerned about hazards on the Hawthornden land, given that it's part of the alluvial fan?
Yes, it is. Area A, I think they've made an effort to push the zones outside of the identified area of Stony Creek fan itself, but the wider area is across that, isn't it? Well, that's something I raised with Area A as well, is that at the time of subdivision there could well be mitigation required, and the landscape assessment hasn't really talked about the impacts of if there needed a bund or something in front of to shield the building platform areas from flooding, from debris flow associated with the alluvial fan, or flooding vents.
That's all I have. Do you want for any more? Going to Studham Road, rural lifestyle zone.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Barr, I followed the analysis through to your preferred use of a BRA along Kangaroo Valley Road. In response to Ms. Millsop's concerns, they're trying to find a simpler way to make it happen. What I was unclear of was where the 60 metre proposed width came from.
Metres is the distance of the closest building that exists.
Right.
From the legal boundary of Kangaroo Valley Road.
And are you satisfied that... Well, let me ask you this first. In terms of your understanding of how the PDP subdivision mechanism works, how does land identified for a BRA that can still be someone's site area and accounts towards density, etc., doesn't it? So if we look at the indicative plan on page 53, which shows indicatively a 60 metre wide box in blue, you're satisfied that those existing titles that front the road that would be subject to the BRA, would they still be benefiting from the rezoning sort, or would the BRA benefit all the other landowners but not those, in terms of what's left and fitting in sites and et cetera, et cetera?
The building restriction area doesn't affect your sort of yield or the density of your site. It just stops buildings, yep. It just discourages buildings from going to certain areas. So those sites who have affected by the BRA, it only affects where they can put future buildings, not the overall allotment size sort.
Well, density is one thing, which is number of units per total area, but in terms of any applicable net site area or minimum site area requirements, Simon, I just want to be clear that the method proposed to help give the relief sort isn't, in fact, not giving the relief sort, if you follow my thinking.
Yes. No, I think that'd be okay. I mean, even with the larger, let's use the bottom, the southernmost site as an example. You could put a building platform somewhere else on that, and the subdivision, as long as it's behind or out of the blue line, and the allotment could simply be, the parcel could be sliced through the middle of the site, so they both end up sharing the building restriction area.
Okay, is there anything that a 60 metre building restriction width does, for the sake of argument, that a 40 metre width restriction area doesn't do? So I understand now where 60 came from. The other question is is 60 the right one?
Well, it's just looking at the existing pattern of development. And so if the logic behind that was just maintaining, obviously layering, high density or infill, but just maintaining that sort of pattern as much as you can along Kangaroo Valley Road, it seemed relatively logical.
In terms of Kangaroo Valley Road as one, SH6 and 84, whatever it turns into, on the other side is the other one. If I were to ask you where there are these key arrival road into Wanaka setbacks, what are the typical kind of widths they tend to be? Is 60 metres consistent with what they are, or is this notably wider or shallower?
Well, if you look at figure 6 on the opposite page, on page 54, that's zoned rural, and there's a subdivision consent granted on that site, which is being developed. You might have seen the roads installed and a few trees there. The building platforms are located on that plan, and they look like they're about 50 metres back, 60 metres back as well. That was part of that that was an emphasis of that resource consent having been involved with it. And that's Cadrona Valley Road, State Highway 6, and then State Highway 84. I mean, a lot of it's zoned rural still, and you've got the golf course, council reserve on one side as you come into the Anderson Road roundabout, and on the other side of the road there's the building restriction area of L&D Farms, which I recommend is maintained, which is about 40 metres wide.
Okay, look, the questions were coming from my reflection of Ms. Mousoff's discussion to us, and she talked about that stretch of Cardrona Valley Road from Riverbank Road up to effectively Orchard Road and stuff, and it's having a particular quality to it that was important to be retained. But look, I've got no other questions, thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Hudson?
No, thank you, sir.
Commissioner McClure? Yeah. Once again, Commissioner Monroe's asked the questions.
Hey, maybe I shouldn't get those next time, sir.
Yeah, that's good. Put it into the test.
Yeah,
good
point.
Should shut that. Keep on, please. Willow Ridge, Section 11 of Your Evidence in Chief. Just waiting with the Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you, sir. So, Mr. Barr, this one seems a reasonably straightforward one, that there's no industrial zones at this point in time, and the suggestion is there might be merit, but this isn't the forum for it. Have I got that in a nutshell?
Well, it's the forum if the submitter wants to push it. I mean, you know, they can ask for any other type of zoning.
Did the submission include, as part of its documentation, so they've just said they'd like the operative industrial B zone.
Yes.
So that's identified relevant objectives, policies, rules, methods, which would be everything that's in that zone. So we know what the provisions would be.
Mm.
Did the submission include any of its own Section 32 type?
No, it's quite a short submission.
Okay. All right, nothing further, sir.
Commissioner Hudson?
No, thank you, sir.
Commissioner McLeod? Yeah, well, it does surprise me that it's quite a short submission, because one of the ongoing discussions was the improvements to the Riverbank Road Ballantyne intersection, and there was discussion, if I recall, about the Riverbank Road. If you look at figure 9, it gives you a good overview of that intersection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually wrong, so that's the same point. But where Riverbank Road comes down and doglegs down to cross Ballantyne Road, that's actually contiguous. But it was, the discussion was that piece of particular piece of land was going to have, and if you go back to figure 8, the three parts of the other thing, and figure 7, which is the photograph, was going to cross to meet Ballantyne Road, and that was seen as a solution to the problem we have with that intersection. My question is, do we have scope to ask that be considered as part of this?
Well, there's certain things up for grabs if somebody wants some sort of zoning on that land. It's the first I've heard of this situation, so it's in the hands of the submitter to offer something, as you know, because part of the relief, part of the issues I've identified with that site is that it's the resource consent that's granted on it provides quite a nice edge or transition out to the rural zone. It's not uncommon to see roads proposed over future plan, over plan change land, but in terms of there actually being scope within their submission, has it something that Scott might like to answer?
Actually was inexperienced enough not to know who to direct it to, but it's a question I'd like to ask. I just don't know if I'm.
I think it's a live issue. I think the submitter said, "Zone my land industrial B. By the way, use this part of it for a future road or for road." That's probably part of the submission.
Because just being part of the discussion around plan change, was it 42?
Yes, well, it's something, Commissioner, that we'll just have to wait and see what the submitters come up with. If you haven't filed any evidence yet.
But why?
Yeah.
Well, his submission hasn't given us any.
Can you please explain to me the status of designation 51?
It's still the old form of monitor oxidation ponds. They're still designated for that purpose. There's a building restriction area over them, presumably to do with reverse sensitivity issues. It was rolled over. It was requested by the council to be rolled over in the notified plan. I'll check the council's reply version. Or if you'd rather, I just deal with it in the reply and move on. That's fine as well.
That I think we're given the time, Dave.
Yeah.
If we leave it for you to confirm the position. But I suppose I'm reflecting on the fact that when we went out to see, there's no continued obvious evidence of oxidation ponds there. And so I'm interested as to on what basis the council is retaining the designation. So if you could address that in reply, please. And the other question is, we had an extensive discussion as part of the Stream 1 hearing as to what is urban development. Is the proposed, we also talked about a definite council proffered a revised definition of urban development. Would industrial development on this site be urban development, to your mind, based on the amended definition? That
yes, it would. Pretty certain that it would. I've also considered the consented activity being outside the urban growth boundary too, but that's where your next question was going.
Indeed. Do you think, is it a necessary consequence if we were minded to grant this that shifting the urban growth boundary, or would shifting that boundary be out of scope?
I don't think shifting the boundary would be out of scope, because I think it would be a consequential change to affecting an urban zone. But Ms. de Glasner has identified infrastructure constraints on that site. So at the moment, I think my recommendation is that consented activity fits quite well, because it's got some landscaping treatment on the edge. It seems to be relatively low in demand in terms of contractor's yard facility rather than a general industrial manufacturing. They might use a lot of water and wastewater. So the consented activities suit it quite well in terms of the infrastructure constraints. If we zoned it Industrial B, just because they've got here as a resource consent for a contractor's yard, might be an upzoning that council doesn't have capacity for. Or if it does, it needs to know that it's coming so it can undertake those upgrades, campaign for those upgrades.
Thank you. Any return? Road.
My question, Mr. Barr, isn't specific to this submission as much as it is to the recurring theme of these very large-scale submissions that could individually lead to hundreds of new units. Given the requirements that the NVS has now imposed on council vis-à-vis a stronger and clearer alignment of infrastructure, and notwithstanding where we might fall on the issue, at least your view to date that big chunks of land with no feasible or known infrastructure solution aren't going to be consistent with what the NPS is requiring, would it, in your view, be a sound and safe conclusion for us to reach, to recommend a submission on the basis that the NPS requirements to be met would require infrastructure plans to also be in place which don't exist? I.e., could we say reject submission because NPS requires infrastructure plans that have not eventuated? Or would our decision reasoning need to include a host of other reasons as well?
I think it's a strong reason, and I think it's a strong reason off the back of the council committing to servicing infrastructure within the urban growth boundary.
Because one might double take a decision of a council in response to an NPS intended to boost the supply of land, being one forced to not rezone land. But in your view, nonetheless, that of itself would be a sound resource management conclusion for us to reach.
Yes, it would be. And if there was land that was zoned that had known constraints, I think then that would have to be reflected somewhere in a statutory document.
Okay, thank you. That was my only question.
Commissioner Hudson?
No, thank you.
McLeod? It's expensive. Jackie Redeye et al. Commissioner Hudson, would you like to step forward?
Going back to I was satisfied after the hearing Mrs. Malsop that I didn't have anything further to ask Mr. Barr.
Commissioner McLeod?
Can I ask the same question that Commissioner Munro asked with regard to this section? With regard to Orchard, the only difference being multiple landowners.
Question being related to
is
infrastructure from that perspective, or
NPS infrastructure. Council commitment to providing infrastructure is therefore a sound resource management reasoning. Because one of the majors is obviously notwithstanding Ian Percy.
Yes, I was going to say that. I mean, Mr. Glasner identifies infrastructure with this submission as well. There is an intensive rural activity happening within the centrally within that site.
Centrally be growing above, but
towards the northern part, is it? Mr. Percy's orchard, vineyard. I think the fundamental issue, and not to forget that the rural residential zone could be self-reliant, it probably wouldn't be impossible to put a bore in there, and 4,000 square metres you could be self-serviced, but I think the fundamental issue is landscape. But looking at the legacy of developments in the Upper Clutha, I think that people would probably have an expectation of that type of development that close to the urban growth boundary that they could put their hand up and expect to be serviced at some point in the future.
Which is essentially what Orchard Road's doing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yes. has other things going on with the submission as well, besides the NPS itself. Sorry, that was my answer.
That's fine. I thought it was, I thought it was more coming in.
Question on the right?
Nothing.
Nothing from me. We'll make road submissions.
No, sir, because I did discuss this with Ms. Nelson.
Commissioner McLeod. Yep, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, Mr. Bard, you concur with Ms. Nelson that given the floodplain and the terrace, that dwellings would necessarily cluster at the top by the road, and on that basis, from the road anyway, give it a considerably more urban character than the zone might suggest. Do you have the same view?
Yes, yeah. I do agree. And the environment at the moment, if you drive along Riverbank Road, you can see the houses along the top quite close. They appear relatively intensive. Mm-hmm. Some quite small 1 hectare blocks of land as well, which sort of show how that 1 hectare doesn't, well, arguably 1 hectare struggles to absorb a house, depending on what sensitivity or what your perception of rural character is. But no, I agree that in all likelihood the dwellings will be sandwiched up the top.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
Maisie Family Trust.
Can I just ask
sorry.
It's just just reflecting on that. If you look at the site location on the map on page 75, how would you feel about is there a differentiation between the sites to the west of Riverbank Road versus the sites to the east? The east being on the flat there for concentrating on the top, whereas the sites on the west of Riverbank Road below State Highway 6,
I think I'd need to. To me, that would come back primarily to a landscape issue, and I think Ms. Nelson has thoroughly considered that portion of the submission site as well,
yep.
And comes to that view, and I agree with her on that. So I think it's more a case of the rural residential zone would compromise the entrance to Wanaka there. Notwithstanding that there is rural residential zoning on the other side of the road, but the allotment shape right on the corner there, is that Belknees Lane? Maybe not, gives you an example of the sort of subdivision pattern you can expect to see if it is zoned rural residential. So
that is Belknees Lane. Yeah.
Could I then, just on the basis of that, ask a bit of homework for you and Ms. Nelson to just not have another look, but consider those sites on the western side of the road in conjunction with the Ranch Royale position that's been reached, so that those blocks of land effectively north of three parks bounded by the highway and riverbank were being treated in as coherently as possible, and it may be that nothing changes from the recommendations you already have.
Thank you, we'll do.
Now, Maisie Family Trust.
Commissioner Hutton. Commissioner Hudson.
No,
out of 16.2, reading Ms. Nelson note I took in terms of one from her evidence to yours is that she considers failure to identify this site as part of the ONF is in fact an error. The question is just confirm there's no submission that would enable us to extend this the ONF at this location. No one has.
No, there's no specific submission on that site.
That's all from me. We have Percy or Percy, and I confirm the trust.
So, yeah, Mr. Barr, this may not be a district plan question, but I've been around the blocks enough times to realise that vineyard operators sometimes use a variety of sprays and do things like shoot off shotguns to keep birds away and stuff. Are there any consent requirements on any of the plans? Maybe it's a regional plan that have to do with spray drift on what may be being proposed as fairly urban activity around the vineyard. So I'm actually not asking about them being protected by buffers or setbacks. I'm actually more interested in residents being protected from any chemicals they may be using.
The regional plan here would deal with any spray. The regional plan here has a generic rule around discretionary status rule around unspecified discharges that it might fall under, but it might depends on the intensity of how it's being applied and the fact that if urban development popped up next door to them all of a sudden, I don't think that would trigger a rule in that plan. I think it's probably commensurate to the quantity that's applied at any given time.
Could I ask that just be confirmed for us? Because it might help us in our evaluation, the requests for rezoning of land around that site.
Certainly, the Percy's got a further submission opposing the rezoning.
Mm.
And they do see rezoning of his land.
I noticed that too.
And in terms of his submission, Commissioner Clark, Commissioner Hudson?
Nothing.
Nothing from me. Corson and Severs. Anything on my right?
No.
Negative.
Rory B. Rural. Glenn Dean. That's awesome.
Not quite. I've got to find my copy of the document. No, still, I don't have any questions on that.
That's a negative, sir.
Two questions from me. First, about the hazard register, the impressive list. Are any of these material to your mind? To
status, looking at the operative plan, are we talking about the camping ground area in the rural visitor zone?
Let's start with the camping ground.
I'm not sure as the status of the controlled activity for buildings and whether or not if the council has control over hazards. What I can do though, because the summary is, let me have a look. No, the summary has split them out. Campground surrounds. That could be something that could be potentially troubling. But having said that, I'm not recommending the submission supported. So to go a step further and ponder what constraints there might be from a hazards perspective and how the council might manage that through the first application for resource consent. I haven't sort of weighed on that heavily.
I think the the question that's going through my mind is that has Melsop identified an area that she could potentially accept, if not support, on the road side, on the upper side of the campground site under the road, which might seem to be exactly the place where it was closest to the alluvial fan. So hence my question.
Would you like me to come back and compare the hazards with the area that Ms. Melsop thinks is compatible?
Yes, please.
Or, sorry, that she would support?
The other question is, I think I may have read it, can you tell me, no, it's already here, I've just gone past it. I don't need to know that question. Now, 3.8, given the council's opposition to extending the designation, is going anywhere down that track really an option?
No. No. I think that's a conversation between the requiring authority, arm of council, and the lessees.
Another request, this is a document. Can we have a copy of that lease? So I don't have any other additional questions. Is anyone else that on the homestead side?
Mm-hmm.
All right. McAurora. Pinnacle and Cross the Bird. Appendix. How many of these are you still recommending following your discussions with Dr. Reed?
I think the only one I need to look at is the 47.2 hectare site at Southernmost. The other one that Dr. Reed thought was particularly sensitive is the northernmost as well, the 50.11 hectare, but given the recent development in there and given the subdivisions that have happened in that area, I'm comfortable with it being retained as rural lifestyle zone. It is quite close to the, is that the one that's quite close to the Pipson Creek?
Yes, Pipson Creek is at the southern end of that.
Yeah, well, there was a house, I think it's like a Quaker barn type design, but it's a residential, pretty sure it was a residential unit, was consented only a few years ago, 2012, 2013.
The one that Dr. Reed couldn't believe was consented, that one.
Yeah, well, it got there. So, natural hazards are a matter of control. All I can say is that the plan must be doing its job and that house went somewhere where the effects are deemed to be appropriate in terms of the natural hazard risk.
And the question about that northern one, the question that took my eye is that there are effectively two lots, two current lots, or 16.6 and 16.3 hectares, which would seem to be a lot of potential rural lifestyle development and quite a sensitive site. I think Dr. Reid described it as hard up against the national park boundary.
Yeah, it's got that stands of mature, probably Manuka, in that part of the world, sort of 4 or 5, 4 metres high, and then straight up into the beech forest of the national park. At this point in time, I'm going to maintain that it's stays rural lifestyle, and I say that because unlike other parts of that zone that I'm recommending be removed, there's potentially capacity to absorb development on that site because of the stand of mature indigenous vegetation in front of it. And just as a note, the proposed district plan would limit the operative district plan didn't have indigenous vegetation clearance rules in the rural lifestyle zone, believe it or not. So anybody could clear that vegetation in the macro rural lifestyle zone as a permitted activity. The proposed district plan, it's district wide, and on sites on that site you would probably have a permitted clearance of 500 metres squared. Any vegetation over 4 metres is reduced to 50 metres squared. So I'm relatively comfortable on the basis of everything I've put to you in terms of the consented environment, the actual development that's happened, the fact that you can get screening on that site, even though I accept it's very sensitive and Dr. Reid recommends it shouldn't be rural lifestyle, that could, I, however, from an overall planning perspective, think that it could be retained as rural lifestyle.
Have you considered the ability to service it, given I understand no telecoms up there?
I don't think that issue's failed to the type of people who might like to live there. Not to say that they don't want to communicate with people, I'm saying that perhaps people go there for a holiday and don't necessarily, it's not important to them to have telecommunications.
Do you know that?
No, that's an assumption. I don't know. They didn't have telecommunications. I mean, the power will be... it's not uncommon for remote sites to have, you know, self-sufficient electricity as well. But I think there's power running along the road, so...
There is. I think there's electricity lines running down the road.
Yeah. It's not uncommon for people to ask for dispensations at subdivision in remote places to not have telecommunications. So, to summarise all that, sir, I'd like to take the opportunity to look at the southernmost block, unless there's some others that you think I need to look at as well.
That's a good question. I might hold that thought. I need to review my notes of Dr. Reid's evidence. I wrote down.
If you're able to ask me next week, I won't get this before next week, so if you're happy to ask me then, I can look at it, that's okay.
I'll give you a list. If there are any additional ones I want you to look hard at. And of course, we'll wait to hear what Ms. Pennycook and Forrest and Byrne have to say too.
Anyone else on Lake Aurora?
Lake Mackay Station. Mr. Scott, that case I referred you to, is it an absolute snooker for LMS trying to broaden the SNOs?
I don't know the answer to that yet. It is on my list of homework.
All right. Mr. Hudson?
Yes, thank you. Bar, just in relation, first of all, to the your recommendation that Lake Mackay's submission be accepted in part relating to the area adjoining Lovett, 4.5 hectares. I'm interested in your reasoning for going against the recommendation of Mr. Glasner. In this particular instance, he said no servicing capacity, and you recommended that, notwithstanding that, there should be a rezoning. And it's also located outside the urban growth boundary.
A rural residential density, you can provide on-site wastewater disposal, and in terms of water supply, it's not uncommon to obtain poor. There's also a lot of Lake Mackay Station have substantial thing permit rights through Lugget Creek. There's a large irrigation pond that they use for farming purposes on the bottom of the terrace at the end of Wanaka Airport, so I don't see servicing to be an insurmountable issue for a rural residential density zoning on that site. But it's important to acknowledge that there are capacity issues extending that far out of Lugget.
Do I understand that you're making a distinction then between rural residential within the urban growth boundary, where you see there is an expectation that the council will provide services, and in a situation like this outside the urban growth boundary, same zoning, but where...
Same density. Yes, certainly.
Excuse me, I wonder if we're going off on a false premise. When you say within the urban growth boundary, do you think the Colton and Commission?
I mean, in general, the discussion that we've had about infrastructure, and Mr. Barr indicated that within the urban growth boundary there was an expectation relating to the zoning, rural residential zoning, within the urban growth boundary that sites would be serviced.
Well, there's no rural residential zoning in the urban growth boundary, but the large lot zoning is...
I might have the wrong terminology.
That's right, and generally anything within the urban growth boundary, I think the council, people should, well, there's an expectation that it would be serviced. It would be case by case. In this instance, because the density is relatively low, being 4,000 square metres, I think it could be self-sufficient, just like some remote rural residential settlements are, like at Halwea Flat, for instance. But on the other hand, if they were proposing, if they had scope for an urban density, it would be a different story, and I'd be a bit more, not realistic, but I'd be mindful of the fact that, in all reality, an urban development would expect to be serviced with some sort of reticulated scheme. And even if they said they'd undertake a private water and wastewater scheme, I'd be a little bit concerned that in the future the residents would want simply the council to pick up the tab for that. But that's not the case here because it's rural residential. And it's not, I'm not sure how many houses that I've recommended while I'm talking to you, but you're in there. So it's a different scale and intensity. And in this case, I think it's okay to assume that they can be self-reliant in terms of servicing.
Thank you. I might have one more, but perhaps if one of the other commissioners has questions, I can come back to
it. I'll fire into it. In relation to the discussion of 8.5, Ms. Malsoff was comfortable that it would be a logical extension of the existing residential areas. Although there is currently no urban growth boundary for Lugget, is your view that there are policies, I recall, about extensions of the small settlements in, I'm not sure if it's chapter 3 or chapter 4. Is this proposal consistent or inconsistent with those strategic
policies? Well, I think my recommendation is consistent, where it's using Atkins Road as the boundary. And I acknowledge from Ms. Melsop's perspective, from a more landscape perspective, that the land on the northern side isn't particularly sensitive. But notwithstanding that, from an overall planning perspective, I can think it would constitute sprawl. And I don't think that relying on an existing established farmhouse sitting in the middle of a couple, 100 hectare paddock to be a precedent for urban growth on that northern side of Atkins Road.
And my recollection from our site visit is that there's a small area of land down on the flat beside Atkins Road, but the rest of the area is up on a terrace and completely out of sight truck below.
Yes, well, if it's not completely out of sight, and I'm thinking here mainly from State Highway 6, southern approach to it, at least it's pushed back far enough as to not be sort of prominent, rather than, it's not so much the issue of the housing being completely invisible, but it would probably read more as part of the staying out of landscape terms, of course, but I think it would resemble and read more as part of the existing development in that part of Luggett.
Yes. And in terms of the infrastructure point, going back to, we should have asked Mr. Glasman this, but I'll invite your opinion. He expressed himself as comfortable with the Hawthornden rural residential proposal on the basis it would be self-sufficient, even though it was hard up against the UGB. And can you suggest any reason to distinguish this proposal, which is where there's no UGB, but his concern is that it's adjacent to the Luggett scheme boundary, which is effectively the same thing?
Yes, well, that's probably more about capacity. If Mr. Glasgow might have been looking at the Atkins Road one strictly through the lens of it being serviced and identified capacity issues, but if it was self-serviced, I'd be surprised if can't speak for him, but if it was self-service, I'd be surprised if he had an issue. And because it is only, I'm just trying to find out how many dwellings their requested would be.
25. 8.1 on top of page 26.
And if Mr. Barr's recommendation is accepted, it'll be less than that because he's carved a bit off the top.
A lot less. I've carved quite a lot off. Yeah, I had 29 units. That's what the recommended would be. My recommendation's quite a bit smaller. Mr. Glasgow might not share my cynicism over people installing community wastewater schemes right next to council schemes, then expecting them to putting their hand up for them to be taken over by the council, but it has happened.
I don't want to put words in Mr. Glasgow's mouth, but I think he might share your cynicism.
Some crucial error. Now, Mr. Barr, we're at 5 o'clock. Ms. Scott's kind of said that you'd kindly come on to finish, but I wondered if you might like a break to stand up, do cartwheels.
Yeah, thank you. 3 or 4 minutes will
do the job. Mr. Chair, just before we move on from that, Mackay, I have looked at the case that you've referred to. I agree in terms of what you suggest. It is, of course, confirmation by the High Court of a consent order that was filed by a number of parties. but essentially what it does provide is that the courts have consistently held that whether a site is significant and so triggers the requirement to protect under Section 6C as an ecological assessment and is not to be conflated with management or planning considerations. In this instance, the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement and the Canberra RPS also are relevant, not so here, but Section 6C certainly is.
In other words, they're applying the same logic as man of war to SNAs.
They are, yes. I'll just the name of the case, just for the record.
Do you think, since you've got it in front of you, you could email it to the hearing administrator? Save me the trouble of downloading?
Yes, just for the record, it is Rural Forest and Bird and Christchurch City Council. 2017, New Zealand High Court 865.
Thank you. We'll adjourn for 5 minutes.
Thank you. 5 past 5.
For one, take good money.